your writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Hey, hello everyone, and welcome to Words to Write By. How you doing, Kim?
I'm doing okay. It's been a long day. Kids are out of school, and you know.
It's that time of year. So what have you been up to lately?
I have been writing almost nothing, except that we've been writing Instagram posts. And the art of writing an Instagram post is special in and of itself. Part of your word count is your hashtags. And we have an Instagram account, Words to Write By. That's pretty much it. That's all of my creative endeavors this week. How about you, Renee?
Pretty good. Don't forget to follow us. I'm doing pretty good, sort of. I'm reaching this point in my book, in my manuscript for my memoir, where I'm just like hating everything I write. Of course, I go into crazy mode, which involves writing outlines of chapters of other people's memoirs and then comparing them with mine and then me just being very sad. So that's what I'm doing right now. I'm hyper-focused on theme.
I think a lot of people just assume that a memoir is you just write what happened to you. And obviously you're saying it's a lot more than just writing down what happened to you. Do you find that you're unique in your approach to writing memoirs? Or do you think most successful memoirists have a hard time putting their story together?
I don't know. I mean, I read a lot of books on writing. And it seems as if everybody kind of deals with this. Maybe some are more natural than others on how they put together their memoir. But no, it's not just about what happens. In fact, what happens isn't even that interesting. Someone could have a very interesting life and write a really boring memoir. But if you look at a lot of memoirs, some of them, they don't even seem like a lot is happening in them. Maybe they just went on a vacation. But somehow they made it super interesting. So mine is the one where lots of interesting, crazy things happen. I just have to put them in an arc, which being a poet is hard. I went and did poetry, so I didn't have to write story arcs. But now I'm writing story arcs.
Just one story arc, right?
Maybe.
And with that, chapter 3.
In chapter 3 of The Art of Fiction, Gardner is on a quest to illuminate the qualities and characteristics of great literature. We discuss his dichotomies, immediate pleasure versus aesthetic vision, poetic versus essay style, conventional versus innovative, as well as his interpretations of scene, plot, emotion, and symbolism in novels. We also argue the merits of writing a story about Helen of Troy to demonstrate these ideas. And for today's exercise, we come up with plots.
Okay, chapter 3. I would like to start by pointing out that chapter 1 of Gardner's book, The Art of Fiction, is 14 pages long. Chapter 2 is 22 pages. Chapter 3 is 43 pages.
Dang.
It was really good we were reading this for a podcast because it was hard to get through.
I would have given up.
So, high five.
Woo.
For finishing the chapter.
Oh, so what was this chapter about?
It was about interest and truth.
Aw, how cute. It makes no sense.
The book's progression is he starts with chapter 1 saying there are no rules of fiction. He goes into chapter 2 in which he has this set of theories of the way different fiction genres work. But then this is the chapter where he says, okay, this is what true great literature is.
Right, I think. He was very argumentative in this chapter. Sometimes I wasn't always sure why, but he had things he had to say.
Yes.
So he had a lot of verses going on, these comparisons or dichotomies. And we noticed three big ones.
the first dichotomy he brings up is the immediate pleasure versus aesthetic vision. This is where he starts off with his definition of what popular fiction is and his definition of what literary fiction is. And surprisingly, he actually admits that he liked Howard the Duck, which apparently is the most pop culture comic book he could come up with at the time.
Yeah, and he kind of lambasted teachers for teaching boring literature, or at least sucking the joy out of literature in order to just teach themes and things you could test instead of just having students read to gain a pleasure from reading.
So he definitely has a bone to pick with teachers. But he brings up the idea of immediate pleasure versus aesthetic vision. And he actually admits that TV series and movies and comic books give immediate pleasure. Their plot, their action, their intensity connects with readers, and we want to read them.
He does say that drugstore fiction can often have more to offer than fiction thought to be of a higher class.
But what he does say is the problem with popular fiction. What was the quote?
The reason may in some cases be snobbery, but probably just as often the cause is the sensitive reader's too frequent experience of disappointment.
And so what he was talking about is when you're reading popular fiction is that you see the same plots over and over again. You see the same turns and twists. In fact, if you look at the way screenwriting is taught, there's actually a formula where this is where the action comes in. This is where some issue pops up. This is the dark tea time of the soul. And once you become aware of what the rhythms of a movie script are, you can't go to a movie without seeing those rhythms.
Right. And in writing, a lot of times you're going to come across that hero's journey template that they say all stories, you know, it's some universal plot, but there's other plots, there's other formulas. You'll find a lot of novel writing formulas on the internet. I think John Gardner would put those in this category. Sometimes it can be good if it's good storytelling, but you get it too much and it's just going to deflate, and this reading the same story over and over again gets boring.
So what he's trying to teach is how to write stories that don't get boring over time because they follow the same templates. I actually found a really good quote. Every element we encounter is worth savoring. Every character is sufficiently vivid and interesting for his function. Every scene is just long enough, just rich enough. Every metaphor is polished. No symbol stands out crudely from its matrix of events. Yet no resonance goes completely unheard, too slightly muffled by the literal. Though we read the work again and again and again, we can never seem to get to the bottom of it. And wouldn't we all like to write that novel?
Yes. Yes, we would.
So that's kind of the first dichotomy. And then you were talking about the second dichotomy you found.
He talks about styles, and he says that the writer has a choice. You have to pick a style. And he says there's two main styles. There's the subjective versus objective. Or he actually says poetic versus essay style. This is the example he uses. This would be an objective style. The man in the doorway was large and apparently ill at ease. So large that he had to stoop a little and draw in his elbows. We can clearly see what this is. There's no question that there's a man in a doorway and that he's very big. It comes across very clearly. This is the subjective or poetic style. He filled the doorway, awkward as a horse. We're utilizing some literary elements like metaphor to create this image in a poetic style. Listeners, I'm not sure if you like Margaret Atwood. I love Margaret Atwood. If you've read A Handmaid's Tale, it is clearly written in a very poetic style. If you read the sequel to Handmaid's Tale, I believe it's called The Testaments, it is written in a very essayist style. The differences are very clear, and I guess you just pick between the two. He didn't seem to judge one or the other.
He specifically said this is a literary style. When he was writing this, the poetic style was more prevalent, but he was clear this is the style of the time and that it can move back and forward as one thing becomes popular or something else becomes popular. I will say that the advantage of using the poetic style is that you don't have to write quite as much. If you looked at the two passages that you read, one of them is much shorter. It causes the reader to fill in more of the details. I was trained in writing journalism. Before that, I wrote standard scientific stuff. It actually has been quite liberating to realize that I can write less and have the readers fill in more. One of the reasons why The Handmaid's Tale ages so well is that she never did tell us what was all happening. She let our minds fill it in. And so it's actually a really worthwhile style to explore. Technically, too, it allows you to get away with a lot more stuff.
That's true. I was obviously trained in poetry. it's like a magnet to me, this kind of writing, the poetic style. But it can also create some issues when you are too intentionally poetic. You kind of make it difficult for the reader to understand. So it's kind of hard, and maybe even harder, because you're not being clear all the time and you have to kind of guess, will the reader fill in the blank?
You have to trust your reader to figure it out.
You have to trust your reader, but you also have to know your reader.
So then there's one other dichotomy, conventional versus unconventional. The dichotomy here is how much of the real world do you show? How much do you fit what a reader expects to read when they're reading the plot of a novel versus how much do you change things up and do things differently?
All right. He had a serious bone to pick with experimental fiction. Listen to what he has to say here. So long as conventional fiction remains adequate and worthwhile, innovative fictions are literary stunts. They have a kind of interest as intellectual toys, but they engage us only for the moment. Burn! Essentially, he argues, these people, whoever they are, he never names them.
He probably wasn't invited to those kind of parties.
He was definitely not invited to those experimental poet or experimental fiction writers parties. He really hates these people.
He was doing this back in 1983, 1984. He had no idea that people would someday write novels over Twitter.
Dude, what do you think he would think about flash fiction?
Rolling over in his grave.
Rolling
guy is
over.
Like generating electricity by how fast he's spinning. The first half of this chapter, which was the hardest to get through, was all this literary fiction and ideas he came to. These were the sentences that I had to read multiple times to figure out what the heck he was talking about. And then about 2/3 of this chapter, he devotes to giving an example, like describing a writer writing a piece and breaking down the various parts of the writing. But he chose a very interesting example. What did you think about the Helen of Troy?
Yes, okay, he's trying to take a mythology and turn it into a novel, so he's showing how he would make different choices. I think it's an awful example. But I guess he does believe in a classics literature kind of education, so...
The other day you were saying that Mist of Avalon is one of your favorite books, and it does a very similar thing. It examines Morgan Le Fay's point of view.
That's true. I did. I have a very strong literature background, and I've learned classics. So yeah, okay. And I know Helen of Troy. I've read it.
He chooses a very interesting aspect, though. He doesn't choose Helen of Troy's opinion about falling in love with this guy and, like, leaving her.
None of the fun stuff.
No. He decides to focus in on the moment Helen of Troy realizes that all her relations and countrymen are going to come and try to sack Troy to get her back.
What do you think about specifically focusing on this?
Well, one could say if he had some really good ideas, he didn't want anyone stealing them, so he chose something that nobody would want to steal.
Whoa!
Wow. I think that picking something that wasn't quite so interesting makes us actually focus on what he's talking about. If he picks something that was so obviously the right story to tell, then we might miss it. It's a bit like sometimes it's better to have a professor that's not as good, because you have the really good professors and they give you the lecture and you understand everything, and then you go home and sit down and you're like, I don't understand any of this. Versus those lectures are like, you are struggling the entire time to figure this out and you're having to like question all the points. And because your brain had to struggle, it actually gets in your head more. So we could give him that reason to pick a truly boring plot idea.
Sure. Isn't his background in mythology?
His most famous piece was Grendel, the story of Beowulf told from the monster's perspective.
So maybe that could also be why. And he just wanted to choose some kind of classic literature, I guess.
Maybe someone told him he should put a female in the book.
Ooh, burn, man. Woo, you're on fire.
Okay, so we read through that section. If his goal in this chapter is to explain what he thinks great literature is, he used that example to break down the steps that a writer would go for. He writes, he must shape simultaneously, in an expanding creative moment, his character's plot and setting, each inextricably linked, connected to the others. He must make his whole world in a single coherent gesture, as a potter makes a pot. I marked this quote, not only underlining, but also writing, just do this, no problem. the idea here is he wanted to come up with some structure of how you would break down these parts, because there's nothing worse than having a great idea and writing page after page and not figuring out how to actually get to your story. He starts off with the idea of plot and scene.
You know, I got to give it to him, at least with scene. He made a very good definition of scene. This is what he says about scene. By scene, we mean here all that is included in an unbroken flow of action from one incident in time to another. The action within a scene is unbroken in the sense that it does not include a major time lapse or a leap from one setting to another. Though the characters may, of course, walk or ride from one place to another without breaking the scene, the camera, so to speak, dollying after them. The action within a scene need not be unbroken in the sense that it includes no flashbacks or brief authorial interruptions for background explanation. So essentially, the character's mind can drift. The character can go into a flashback. They can do all of these things. But if you're moving them in setting, like if lots of time is passing, that's not the scene.
And this could be a very novel concept to someone. Someone who's been like just reading on their own might not have keyed in that they're reading scenes, because if it's done really well, it just seems like the most natural thing in the world. But break it down, you'd see that there are distinct moments in time in which the action takes place and things happen. By knowing that your story is made up of these scenes, you can analyze, you can amp up something, you can decide what to cut. It's just a really good mindset to explore what you've written or what you want to write.
Exactly. His explanation of scene was, I think, pretty well done. Plot? Meh. But he does have this idea called profluence. And essentially, it just means the flow of time or how we string plot elements together so that there's some kind of coherent timeline. It's kind of confusing.
Going back to your issues with writing your memoir, the thing is that you have had a linear life. All these things happen in a particular order. So you have a starting point and an ending point, but that by itself isn't enough to make a plot.
Exactly. So it could be that I'm just having a problem understanding this idea where we have to rearrange the plot points of our life so that readers experience profluence, which is kind of like anticipation or an order of events in which the reader will enjoy it the most.
I think climax is critical to the idea of plot. A plot rises to a certain point, and then you have the climax and all the action that leads up to it and all the roller coasters that makes it so you can't put down a novel. Because if you think about our actual lives, there are large portions of days and weeks that are not worth mentioning at all. If we want to turn our lives into a story, you really need to figure out what the plot is, where the action happens. And when someone's starting to write a story, when you've got an idea, coming up with exactly what the plot is critical to the writing the story. Writers work out plot in one of three ways: by borrowing some traditional plot or action from life, by working his way back from his story's climax, or by groping his way forward from an initial situation. Here, we come to the issue that some people are really good at plot and some people aren't. To use an analogy, some people are really good at math and some people aren't. And usually people that are really good at math are the ones that end up being mathematicians and TAs, and then they sit in front of the class by a whole bunch of people that just don't get math. And it's very hard to bridge that connection. It makes them very frustrated. Likewise, I think some people just get plot.
He says, in an hour, a good writer can come up with plot after plot. And I'm like, no, that's not me.
A particular type of writer can come up with plot after plot after plot. Right. And obviously Garner belongs to the plot after plot. I personally find that I can generate plots pretty darn fast, but it's not a requirement. Just as we talked about grammar last time and some things, there are ways to get through these things. And yes, some people don't have that natural plot generation ability, but they have some other things that make up for it.
So why don't we move on to that primary versus secondary meaning? He calls it primary meaning and secondary meaning, but he also, the next page, calls it primary emotion and secondary emotion.
So we're just going to assume that's the same thing because we don't want to try to define them both.
Right. He says he knows that his first job is to authenticate what I earlier called the story's primary meaning, Helen's surprise. That is Helen of Troy. The surprise is a feeling, but like all conclusive feelings, Helen's surprise suggests some larger secondary meaning, not just one person's feeling, but a universal human feeling. It is usually in this larger secondary sense that we speak of the quote-unquote meaning of works of art. So here he was talking about Helen's surprise that her community came to rescue her, or at least get her back, depending on how you'd like to look at it. She's actually surprised. That is a primary meaning. You start asking as a reader, well, why? Why would she be surprised? What a strange way to react to someone trying to quote unquote save you. But the secondary meaning is a little bit nebulous. The fact that she's surprised implies that she is lacking some kind of kinship with these people. Or it's suggesting of other, maybe more intrinsic human emotions. What do you think?
I think the problem is that neither you or I connect very much with the universal quality of what the story that he's proposing is. I was thinking instead, can you think of any book that you've read that had a primary and secondary emotion? And I've got one myself, so I'll start off with that one and then you can tell yours. Have you ever read any Barbara Kingsolver?
I think so.
The Bean Trees? She also did the Poisonwood Bible.
I read the Poisonwood Bible.
Okay, so the Bean Trees was her first one, and she wrote it while she was pregnant. The premise of it is this 20-something-year-old woman is driving across aimlessly across the country, and she ends up with a 4-year-old child. There are various other stories woven into it. The primary story is the main character and accepting this girl and becoming her mother, and that is the primary emotion, which is a good, heartful one. But the other part comes from the name, the Bean Trees, because they're talking about how beans are nitrogen fixers, which means they can, chemistry. Nitrogen is all around us, but what plants need to grow is what's called fixed nitrogen. And the reason we have to have fertilizer on fields is because most plants can't fix their own nitrogen. And actually, no plants can fix their own nitrogen. They rely on a symbiotic bacteria to do it for them. So it's a symbiosis relationship. All this is to basically say that the book talks about how we all rely on other people. And we have all these connections. And this person starts off alone and she acquires this child, but also along the way she acquires these connections to all these other people. So the primary emotion is character becomes a mom. But the bigger one is the realization that we're all connected in all these ways. And I put down that book and I felt so good towards all humanity when I finished that book. And that's what he's talking about here.
Yeah, I can see that. There's the surface level meaning, and then there's this deeper meaning.
Uh-huh.
The thing that you take away.
Mm-hmm. The reason why you basically tell all your friends to read this book.
Yes, I can totally see that. Maybe in a more simpler way, the book I was thinking of is called Blindness by a Portuguese author named José Saramago.
Yes.
The book will blow your mind because it has really good secondary meaning. What happens is everybody becomes blind. Like the world becomes blind. People can suddenly no longer see except for this one woman. And she essentially becomes kind of like a slave to the other blind people. Like she has to take care of them. And you realize by the end of the book that it's one big metaphor for people going about their life blindly and relying on people who can see things, or at least who are paying attention, to make the world move. I didn't quite catch in the beginning that this was just an extended metaphor. But by the time I got to the end, I thought, oh, that's so clever. Oh, and I totally agree with him.
And that's actually a really good segue to the final thing, which we talked about, symbolic association. He talks about how you can have symbols in the text that help better define the characters, like an individual that's fighting while there's a giant storm raging. So the storm itself is symbolic for the fight that he's having. They're kind of easy to do. I mean, once you start spotting them, you're like, oh, that's a symbol for this. Oh, that's a symbol for that. Oh, that's a symbol for this. Gardner says that you don't just like go sticking symbols in your work. You come up with ideas, you come up with some connections, and then as you're reworking the piece, you see what comes out and you make more out of those symbols. It's an iterative process. It's a bit of your subconscious noticing things they hadn't noticed before, noting parallelisms, and all this work that goes in the editing. It's not something that you just plaster down and say, this is a symbol for this. Nobody likes reading those.
It's very disingenuous to try to put them in artificially like that.
And for somebody that's trying to put in symbols, this is actually a good explanation of how it happens. So you don't feel compelled to just come up with a symbol right away.
It's organic. It's an organic part of the process of writing. Although some people do start writing with the intention to send a message. That is some of the work I don't like, where it seems so heavy-handed. I think this is also connected to, we talked about earlier, which is sucking the joy out of literature. And I think part of the reason people might think that these symbols were pre-planned, because your high school teacher told you that red meant passion and white meant purity and a rose means this. And That's all BS. It's kind of like reading one of those dream books, like, what do my dreams mean? And it's like, a monkey has to mean that. It's like, I don't think so. It's like, there's a way to decode this, but it's really, you have to decode it story by story. Like, the terms and conditions under which these symbols function or even mean anything is dependent upon the actual book it comes from.
I did like this line from the very beginning. He's talking about subtle detailed changes in a character's lives, but I think it could actually be applied to theme in ways too complex for the conscious mind to grasp, though we nevertheless grasp them. I think the best metaphors, the best symbols and stuff are things that we understand, but that we couldn't actually put into words, which is what makes the symbol so powerful, because it says all we need it to say.
Yes. Once in a while, he says something that makes sense.
It's like a koan. You just kind of meditate on the meaning and you pull more meaning out as you go along. So,
or you rely on someone else to give it for you. Not that I'm judging.
But the important thing is, we finished chapter 3.
Oh, dear God. Finally.
Okay. And now, what are we going to give ourselves for an exercise?
We could do a plot, okay. I think. There's this one.
It's on page
198. It's number 5.
Number 5.
Plot a realistic short story beginning with the climax and working backward. What characters are needed for the climax and what are they like? What must be dramatized to authenticate the climax? How many scenes are necessary to achieve the climax?
So here's what we're going to do for this one. We're going to each give each other the climax of the story. And that's where we have to work from.
Oh, man, you're mean. She didn't warn me about this, let me tell you.
Can we start with yours? We're starting with yours, right?
Right. The scene that you gave me. I rewrote this a little bit. So here's how it came out. In a dark, unfinished basement, cement floor, bare wood beams, swinging light bulb, there's a 30-ish man chained to a post. A disheveled, obviously unhinged woman in a wedding dress is approaching him with a large chef knife. It's till death do we part, darling. The man trembles, whimpers, closes his eyes as she comes closer. When out of the shadows jumps a woman who attacks the bride and after dramatic struggle defeats her. She frees the man, they kiss, and maybe some cute quips here. End scene.
Sounds like a romantic comedy.
Wow, Renee, that says a lot about your love life.
That'll be another podcast.
So actually, that's a good point to start. What kind of realistic fiction is this? I was reading it as horror thriller with certain aspects of a romance thrown in or a romantic comedy, but much darker than a pure rom-com.
And then what did you do?
Well, then I need to figure out who the characters are, because the people are what drive the plot.
So what characters did you come up with?
I assigned them random names because it was useful. The guy chained up is the groom and his name is Adam. And the woman that saves him is his actual love interest and her name is Eve.
Of course.
And the deranged woman in the bride's dress is Lilith.
Ah, nice. Nice. Okay.
And the premise is that Adam and Eve were going to get married and that Lilith is a demented bridesmaid who sabotages the wedding and steals the groom because she's in love with him.
Wow. So this isn't a romantic comedy so much as it's like natural instinct.
Yeah. I had a bit of Gone Girl going in the back of my head when I was writing it and was coming up with it. It'd all be told from Eve's perspective. Personality-wise, I made her into very competent, but kind of a little bit high maintenance, sort of like Cher from Clueless.
Okay.
And then the setup is that as she's going along and planning the wedding, everybody around her starts to see her as a bridezilla.
Ooh.
And so everything falls apart as she's putting this wedding together and people get angry and such. From the reader's perspective, we think that it must be Adam that's like, you know, turning on her or something because he's doing a whole bunch of stuff that's really awful. And in the end, you know, he dumps her in a most humiliating way. But in fact, it's her bridesmaid, Lilith or Lily. We give her a really sweet name so she doesn't sound bad, who's actually sabotaging her.
Oh, it is Gone Girl. Oh, that's a good plot.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, so Lily's initially like her small town best friend. They've been close forever. And so she has her be her maid of honor. But then Lily keeps screwing things up. And so she has to demote her to bridesmaid.
Oh. So this is almost an act of revenge. Like her motive is not just, I like your fiance, but also I'm getting you back. Or maybe, well, I'm now doing the activity.
No, go for it.
It could be that the bride once stole a boyfriend from Lily.
Or we could go for the whole thing where she's always been in love with Eve and, you know, she just either is torn up because Eve's going on and moving on with her own life, or she always mm-hmm. wanted Eve's lifestyle and therefore she wants to take Eve's boyfriend, husband. And once you turn someone into a psychopath, their motives get pretty dark.
Right. I mean, jealousy seems to be the fuel here, and it could be jealousy on multiple sides.
So what other things does Gardner say we should be talking about here?
Okay. So what must be dramatized to authenticate the climax?
For the plot that I'm looking for is we need to have a certain set of tropes that the audience is picking up on. So I was thinking if I were to really do this, I would dive in deep to a bunch of advice columns and find out all the horrible things that went wrong with weddings and just list them off. This is one of his authentic details, the verisimilitude, because there are so many things that our bridezilla does.
That's true.
That like, it was just like, that happens. And I saw that happen at one wedding. So that's where we get the details. But then the shift in the plot would have to be at the point where she realized that it wasn't Adam that had done this stuff, or Adam was then in danger, and that was actually Lily. So that would be the other critical aspect of the story. When she gets dumped, we almost have to believe that it's better off that she doesn't have Adam in her life. And then she'd have to discover some clue that actually pointed to it being Lily the whole time.
Okay, so people who've been gaslighted, one of the symptoms is that they constantly second guess everything. And they're, you know, paranoid because they can't determine what's real and what's not. It could be that she becomes so paranoid, like that maybe the bride becomes obsessed with scenarios in which the wedding can go wrong. And that is what drives the fiance away, is she's just convinced herself that it's going to crash and burn, and she creates all these horrible scenarios. Mm-hmm. But really, it's a symptom of the gaslighting that Lily's been doing the whole time. What scenes are necessary to achieve the climax? Describing some of the scenarios in which weddings can go bad that she's...
No. I can just make all those things happen. One example would be, what if the invites to the in-laws got lost and they thought they weren't invited? What if the bridesmaid dresses all came in the wrong size? Eve insisted that they'd ordered them correctly. All the bridesmaids are unhappy at the horrible dresses they have to wear.
Okay, yeah.
Like if you do this right, it should give people PTSD that had horrible weddings.
Yeah. You know what I like about this is it really could be serious or comedic or somewhere in between, which is that nice sweet spot. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Very Bad Things. It's kind of funny, but also disturbing as it gets worse and worse.
I was thinking a totally inappropriate bachelor party, like even though they don't mean to, like strippers show up.
Oh yeah. The bridesmaid would like Lily. She would have totally like orchestrated like this horrible bachelorette party.
So it'd be the bachelor party. She'd arrange for strippers to show up at the bachelor party and then have Eve walk in on Adam at the most inopportune time.
Oh, so Eve would be leaving Adam?
No, she wouldn't be leaving Adam, but they would be setting it up so that it was appearing that Adam was the real problem in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
We'd see Eve breaking down as these things go wrong, but we'd see Adam not supporting her and being accusatory towards her.
I see.
So that when he dumps her, we almost feel like good riddance.
Oh.
But then the surprise is her discovering there's actually a deep, darker force pushing everything this way.
I see. This is a really cool plot. I can predict some critical choices that need to be made that can make or break it. Like whose point of view is the story told in? Are you going to have three point of views? Are you going to have...
I would just do it from Eve's point of view.
Okay. How would you reveal? Well, I guess she must discover.
I do it as from Eve's point of view with some epistolarily. Basically, I'd have like maybe some chat room gossip or something where it was like some outside views of stuff that how everyone's viewing it from the outside. Mm-hmm. Like at some point I'd have someone writing a letter to a Dear Abby thing about this horrible bride. Basically I'd have it all from Eve's perspective, but in between chapters, I had these little like outside moments so we could see kind of how she was looking from the outside to all her friends and family.
So it would be like evidence, almost like a detective thing. Primary documents appear after they all add up. She connects the dots and sees that all of these add up to Lily being the plotter. Wow, that's a good story. I hope you write that, Kim.
I don't think it's one of the ones I want to write.
Well, somebody should. Well, based on what you said, I can already kind of guess what's dramatized, what authenticates that ending of being in the basement. Clearly, there's got to be some scenes showing Lily at different points where she's losing her shit. She has to become crazy over time. She can't just do it at the last second. Unless maybe that's just a big reveal at the end. And this kind of story, it might be okay if she's just revealed to be nuts.
You could give hints that she's not as stable as she should be, but they could all be interpreted in the reading as her feeling for Eve, or not feeling that
right.
Adam was good enough, or feeling uncomfortable with the situation that Eve is putting her in. And that's why I got the Gone Girl, because the Gone Girl paints a scenario where everything fits in a particular thing, but then it forces you to reexamine.
I also feel like the things going wrong with the wedding, those all have to be in scene. I want to see all of the things crash and burn for her wedding and see how the bride reacts. Maybe the first time something goes wrong, she reacts, but semi-reasonably. Then the next thing that goes wrong is even worse. And then as the story progresses, everything that goes wrong gets worse and she reacts even worse until she herself is like a basket case and supreme bridezilla.
I'm taking the trope of the bridezilla, but I'm putting you in her shoes. I'm showing you her reactions. So we're rooting for her, even though we're seeing her make all these mistakes along the way.
Yeah.
It's like it's having a best friend that you love, but man, she's just living her life in the wrong way and you want to stop her. Then you realize the twist is that it wasn't her ever. It was this outside force.
Right. It wasn't just really bad luck over and over again, or her causing the situation on her own.
Okay. So I think we're going to stop the conversation here. And if you're interested in what Renee did with the plot that I gave her, you can check out our Patreon site. It'll be posted there. Thank you guys so much for listening. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. This is podcast number 3, which seems impossible because it feels like we've been doing this forever. And yet we waited until we got this podcast done before officially launching our site. So that means every like or review that you leave on the podcast subscription service you use to listen to this will make a huge difference in reaching a larger audience. So if you have the time, please leave us a review. Thank you so much. And if you feel our discussions and analysis is helpful for your own writing, then you should check out our Patreon site, Words to Write By. There you can listen to our bonus podcasts, talk with other writers, and find additional writing exercises. Tune in next week when we discuss Gardner's definitions of metafiction, deconstructive fiction, and all that jazz. Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smuka-Otto. Our music is Cedar Trail by Prior Meadows. Come back soon.
Yeah, he really liked to write.
He liked to be wordy. I gotta say, you know, we read these books, listeners, so you don't have to. But man, the sentence I read for you, let me tell you, I'll never get that minute back.